So we want to compare these two models. Does anybody have anybody who doesn't know? Anybody have a guess which one will turn out to be stronger? Everybody knows, or you don't have a guess?
Incomparable?
Well, probably, okay, well, I'm only, yeah, it could be that they're incomparable, but what would you guess which one's stronger? It's not known if they're incomparable. So if only one separation is known, which one do you think it is? What's better, communicate quantumly or share entanglement? Did you know?
No.
Yeah, it's all right. So it turns out what we did, what I guess it comes on the slide. So the question is shared entanglement stronger than public coin? And the answer is, yes. So when it's right, we find a relation, again a relation, not a function. It seems to be easier to analyze relations in this context, such that with entanglement, even though you only communicate classically and you don't do anything fancy, it's log n bits of communication. And here, where you have all these, you know, sheep, public coin, etc., and you communicate quantumly, still you need cube root of n, roughly, quantum bits. It's, you need classical bits, but even with quantum bits, it doesn't work. Less than this. Again, a relation, I'll give you a little flavor of what kind of relation this is, but just the take home message is that entanglement can help exponentially more in some scenarios. Okay. Here it's much stronger than shared randomness. I want to say one thing. Actually, the classical upper bound, so the protocol that does it, we only had one that had quantum communication. And the strengthening to classical communication is a protocol due to Harry Borman, but maybe it's even due to other people. I think it's fairly standard by now. But just to give credit with. Yes.
But that conclusion, I mean, that's really just relative to that.
Sure. I mean, this is just one of the analogies. But yeah, it's relative to, in this setting here, entanglement can be stronger than shared randomness. Not direct, not if you communicate directly. Because you can just follow. Before I come back to this protocol, let me give you yet another thought or result, if you wish. I only focused on this strange model. I mean, it's important, but it's just one model where you communicate with the referee. Of course, you can also analyze, and that's what people do a lot, models where people talk, Alice and Bob talk to each other directly without a referee. And then again, you can analyze the costs, again, the total communication needed. Okay, in the worst case, and you have the complexities that correspond to the other ones, I would always write it two here, meaning that it's kind of two-way communication. When I write a two, it's two-way, even though it's not really standard, but let me do it. So deterministic, randomized with private coin, and in this case it doesn't matter, the private and public turns out to be the same in this model. Quantum with entanglement, and so on. You can write a lot of classes, and again you can compare them. And clearly the S&P model is weaker, right? Because anything you can communicate to the referee, if you can communicate it directly, it can only help you from work, right? And so the question is, one of the questions is, how well can an S&P protocol reproduce this whole thing, reproduce a two-way communication? Or more precisely, actually, we want to ask, when we say S&P, we care about quantum fingerprints. This fingerprinting technique was very strong for equality, and it helps for several other problems. So the question is, how well can it help us? How well can we reproduce something that happens between two people by fingerprints to a referee? Okay? This is the third result in this GKW1 paper, the old one, and it shows the following. It says that this is quantum, this is basically fingerprint. So S&P model with quantum communication is fingerprints, more or less. Think of it like this. Fingerprints can simulate any protocol. The strongest possible two-way protocol is quantum with entanglement. Right, it doesn't get stronger than that. You share entanglement and you communicate quantumly, that's the strongest possible model that there is. So we generalized this result by NDR, which only talked about classical and public, and we generalize it to quantum with entanglement. We show that there is an exponential simulation that anything that you do here, you can do with fingerprints, but with a blow-up of an exponential. Okay, I not going to make the approval, but the idea is to use these fingerprints to kind of encode what's happening here with fingerprints, and you encode the entanglement somehow. Anyway, it's technical. It's a technical proof, so I'm not going to give it, but just for the message, anything you can do with the strongest possible two-way model, you can do at an exponential increase, no matter if it's, I guess it's not so exciting because it's an exponent. But the point is that disentanglement here can be infinite. So the parties can even share infinite entanglement, and still you can simulate it with fingerprints at an exponential increase in the communication cost. So this is all I think I'm going to say about this. There's one more connection before I switch away from this fingerprint. One more connection you make in this GKW1 paper. As I mentioned, all protocols in the SMP model of quantum communication, they are based on repeated fingerprints. So you can fingerprint swap this, etc. All of them are like this. So we don't know anything else that works well. So it might be interesting to see how powerful this repeated fingerprinting technique actually is. So what you do is, right, you try to embed Alice's message, the Bob's message, into a fingerprint, such that if the function is zero, the inner product is kind of small. And if the function is 1, the inner product squared is large. And you want to have this gap quite large because this gap gives you, you know, the distinguishing probability between these two cases. And it turns out, if you just do single probabilistic analysis, you need to repeat this gap squared inverse times to succeed with constant probability to distinguish which of the two cases. Okay, so this is just a setup for the fingerprinting and the parameters. And again, this is the communication matrix, for instance, for equality. What they're trying to do is find kind of a matrix with rows, like a ground matrix, if you wish. Find vectors such that these inner products kind of reproduce roughly this communication matrix. This is what you're trying to do when you're trying to find a fingerprint. Right? By the way, anyway, so there is another big field of computer science where people like to deal with such matrices, except they write a 0 as a 1 and a 1 as a minus 1. But we shouldn't be deterred by this. There are differences, and this is computational learning theory. And what people try to do is similarly, that's what they call a concept class, such a matrix, usually. And what they're trying to do is find what they call margins, embeddings, into half spaces. Never mind what they call it, but what people try to do in this field is find vectors, a bit different from our scenario, such that if this thing is 0, so this thing here is a 1, I guess, then you want to embed it with a positive inner product. And if this thing is a 1, so then it's a minus 1, sorry, so I'm not doing this, then you want to embed it with a negative inner product. So this is what people try to do. They try to find these cut space into half spaces such that all the ones are on one side and all the zeros on the other side, roughly. So they do this for us since dawn of day in their field. And it would be interesting to relate this because they have total results. So we can immediately translate this. And you see the difference to our scenarios. We have inner product squared and we have, you know, delta 1 and delta 0. But this is just, it's very easy to translate this. And it turns out this is just a very short thing that you can relate this to, so this is what they call the margin. The largest gamma that you can find, right, the largest kind of gap here, is called the margin. And so it turns out that repeated fingerprintings can be related to these margins. You just do a little manipulation to get the squares to the non-squares. And you need to repeat this log n over gamma squared. So you can take all the margin results that exist there in learning theory, and immediately get quantum fingerprinting protocols for the corresponding functions with this kind of complexity. Okay, so but they also have law about these people. So they also know how, we try to make this margin as big as possible, this gamma. The bigger it is, the less we need to repeat. Okay? So they have bounds, namely, they have bounds on upper bounds on gamma. Okay, so this is a law in terms of these will be law bounds for our fingerprinting. And in particular, they're related to the operator norm of this matrix here. So the particular gamma is only smaller than the operator norm scaled by the dimension. that's just old here. And so, in particular, we can find functions for which fingerprintings are really bad fit to do. Like the inner product, if you go through this, you know, writing it like this and calculating the operator norm, which is very easy, it turns out that for deep fingerprintings, you need to do it 2 to the n times, which is really bad because you can just send the input, which is length n. So this gives us ways to give us weaknesses to fingerprinting coming from this learning theory business. The other connection, this is slightly more exciting, lower bounds, I don't like lower bounds, I prefer upper bounds, but anyway. Oh, this is also lower, I'm sorry, but anyway. The more exciting connection is we can also, remember I told you we can simulate anything that happens between two people with fingerprints. Now if we have a lower bound, let's see if I do it right, if we have a lower bound on the fingerprints, this also gives a lower bound on what you can do between two people. Except now you have to put a log factor in, because this was an exponential simulation. So in other words, bounds, you can get from bounds on margins, from lower bounds or upper bounds on margins, like this bound Foster and Cycling, you can get lower bounds on this kind of communication on this. So there's a little bit, it's a bit screwed up way to do it, but you can get. And in particular, you can relate this gamma, this margin of the matrix, to the quantum two-way communication complexity you get a lot. Okay, so this is, I guess, new this result, but it was independently also obtained by Linier and Schreibmann, who cared more about margins. They didn't actually, until we told them that they had discovered the same thing, they didn't know that they were talking about quantum as well. But so, anyway, so this was independently obtained by them, and they showed a much nicer and stronger result, which is for some reason not yet published, but the words there. Saying, so they also relate the margin to the discrepancy. So for those who know, the discrepancy plays a big role in lower bounds functionally in this scenario. So they show that the margin and the discrepancy are related by a constant factor. And the other direction why this connection could be useful, and this we actually did, so this is something we have about this here. This is just speculation, but you could use this connection to also get new upper bounds on these S&P, so good fingerprinting protocols, strong good margins. And if you take a look in the literature, they have a good margin, you take it to make a fingerprinting protocol for this function. And you can also, of course, if we already have a good fingerprinting protocol, right, then it immediately translates into a good margin. So you can find somehow, you can take a good fingerprinting protocol, even say from a quantum protocol like this, and then the simulation. So if you do it smartly, you could get a new margin result. So you get a new quantum classical result, which is a very fashionable one these days, so I'm writing it to you. But we didn't actually do it, we don't have a good candidate, but you could. Okay, so that's fingerprints are over, if you can, new topic, or old topic. I'm going back to this relation that separated public coin from quantum communication. Yes? No. So remember, the first question I asked was, can you simulate public coin with quantum? And we saw that equality fingerprints were. And then here we say that this is not always the case, and there is a relation where it doesn't work. So let me give you this relation so you get the flavor of how these things look like. They look very much like equality, but they are relations. So what do? Alice gets a bit string X. Okay. Bob gets a bit string Y, and he also gets another bit string S. And this bit string S is just like a mask. It has half zeros and half ones. And we only care about the positions where there is a one. So what the referee is supposed to output is just XI, YI, and I. Just one bit and, you know, the index and the two bits. But for a thing where the mask was one. Okay? So you have Bob has in his hand like kind of a list of half of the indices that are important, and the referee is just supposed to output one of the important indices, X, I, and Y. So this is really like here's the mask. So these are the important indices, and the referee is just supposed to output, say, second bit 1, 1, or whatever. Any of those would be good. Okay? So what can you do with a public coin? It's a totally trivial task. All you have to do is you just pick a random index and you send, you know, xi and log sends yi and si. Right? If si is 1, then you got a good index, and the ref can just output, and they said finally, the ref can just output I as I1. Right? And if SI is not 1, which happens with probability half, you just repeat. And if you repeat a constant number of times, you get a good probability. Right? Some index is good. And that's all we care about. So it's a totally trivial, classical public point of number. Okay, so the problem is the
question. Yeah, this may be a simple question, but when you repeat it a bunch of times, you don't actually know what you want. Does that matter?
No, the referee knows, because if SI is 0, he knows this was a crappy bit, so let's repeat again. I mean, they just repeat 50 times, and if one of these S's is 1, the referee will output. So, you mean Alison Bob don't know? Or don't
how would the referee just have the S's?
Yeah, Bob sends the SI along as well.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, so Bob sends 2 bits and Alice sends 1 bit. Yes. Yeah, otherwise, I don't know how. So, anyway, so it looks totally trivial, but you would think that. Ah, sorry. So this is wrong. So the other one, I also present the other one because it's very similar, and they all have this kind of similar flavor, but you'd think, okay, let's cut the public coin, let's take that quantum, maybe they should be, maybe, I don't know. So we show that if you don't have this resource of a public coin, even if you're quantum, you just can't do it. Even though it's such a simple thing. Now, I'll answer you now. In the second one, let me give you the second relation, because there I want to give you also the upper bound, because even though it's due to Harry Borman, you still might learn something out of it. So, this is the one, again, where Ray guessed that entanglement helps over a public coin, even if communication is quantum. So, again, Alice gets a bit string. Alice has this string X. And now Bob, here's a string. What Bob gets is a bit more complicated. He gets a matching of the bits. So he gets like kind of edges. X1 goes with X3. And X2 goes with X5. Sorry, 1 goes with 4. 3 goes with N, and so on. So he gets edges, right, that connect the disjoint matching pairs of indices. And he gets another string. This is just a technical thing. He gets a string. For each edge, he gets a bit. Okay. And what the referee is supposed to output from one of the edges, no matter which one, is to output the two endpoints, I and J, and the XOR of the bits of Alice. Okay. And then for technical reasons, also this bit Y that Bob's holding. So this we can get rid of, but this sampling is actually not here. Anyway, this is a variation of, for those who know, of the problem that Barrios Dialogue and Kilanidis used to prove the opposite separation. Okay, so they prove the opposite separation when you take their problem modified, and not quite the opposite in this case, but a similar separation the other way for a public coin. So it's a variation of the, what's called the hidden matching problem. Right? One is the matching, the other is the bit, and you want to know the XOR of one of the edges, XOR of those bits that the other one holds. Is that clear? Yeah? Okay. How do you do it with entanglement and classical communication? So I want to show you how to do it with log n classical bits. Alice has the script, right? And Bob has this matching. And they share log n EPR pairs, right? They have entanglement. So here is the EPR state, they share Alice and Bob. So what do we do first? This is again very standard in these kind of things. Alice takes her string and puts it in the phase. So this is a local operation, right? She does the controlled thing on I, she puts X, I in her phase. So what's the final state? It's just this state here. Okay? And now, Bob makes a measurement, does a measurement. What he does is, he has these edges. So he has a pair of the indices I and J, and he measures with projectors that are two-dimensional for each edge. So he has an N over two projectors, P, I, J, right? So the edge 1, 4, he would have 1, 1 plus 4, 4. So he projects on the two-dimensional space. So if he does this, he gets one of the N over 2 outcomes. Okay, he can't control which one, but he gets one of them. And the state that is, remains from this whole fixed state after he gets the outcome IJ is just II, and then the phase. We know that we put this in the phase, so I'll take a minus 1 out and put it here, and you get this a phase plus or minus depending on the XOR of the two bits. Okay? Originally, you have a minus 1 to the x to the i here and a minus 1 to the x to the j. If you take out the global phase, you get this. So now it's already fairly easy to see what to do, right? Because it's So at this point, you know that it's in the phase, you could just measure in the plus minus spaces somehow. Send the quantum bits and have the reference measure. But this would be a quantum protocol. So the ingenuity of Harry was to see that you don't even need quantum. You can do it classically. All you have to do is both of them apply in one month, Alice and Bob. So they have this thing and they want to kind of communicate this phase that they share. So they don't need to send the state, they just apply a Hadamard to all of their bits. And if you do the Hadamard, you get kind of this Kullak state and you measure. But the point is that if you measure and you send the classical bits, and the whole magic is that because it's a Hadamard transform, it was in the phase, you have this relation that S plus T times Y plus J is exactly this phase. This is just the magic of the Hadamard transform. If you do the math, you'll see that exactly this. And so since the referee has S and T, and I and J, he can do this thing and he gets this phase. Okay? So the referee has I and J, the phase, and Bob can send the corresponding Y. Okay? So all I've communicated is basically 2 log n bits. That's it. These are the upper bounds. They are all simple. And they took, 1% of all the work of these papers. Now the lower bounds. So the lower bounds for R1 is we have, R1 was the one where we have quantum communication and nothing else. So here we have quantum communication, Alice sends a quantum state, mixed state in general, Bob sends a mixed state, the referee needs to compute something. This is the scenario. For both R1 and R2, it would be relatively simple. So I'm not going to give you the proof, but what you do is you analyze kind of some sort of mixed message for. You call it row 0, the message where the j's fit, j is 0, and you call it row 1j, all those messages were a mixed set of all those messages where the j's fit is 1. Yes?
Julie, you also would give the lower bound when they share classical randomness.
I'm not going to give it, but it works along the same line.
It works.
It's complicated. I mean, I could speak 3 hours about it, but I'm trying to give you the underlying kind of thing.
Because we know that classical shared randomness helps a lot in SNP model.
Yeah, but in this, I mean, I will put more work even with, but I'm not going to use it.
So yes, particular in this relation.
But for R2, we have low bound randomness. It still works. The randomness somehow is not an issue. It's more this information theoretic.
For this particular relation.
No, for the other one. Yeah, for these, also for R2, the same kind of analysis, just more complicated.
That's fine. But what I'm saying is that it's kind of, there's something nice happening here because we know that shared randomness in general helps a lot.
Yeah. So I guess it must also be the relation somehow that randomness won't happen. Anyway, the point I'm getting to is what you have is, right, you get a message from here, you get a message from here, but the referee has is a tensor product of 2 messages in general, always. Okay? And from this tensor product, he needs to kind of infer xi and yi somehow, or j, I should say. Yeah, so in some sense, this is vague. So there is a clear information theoretic proof, but I'm just trying to give you a little bit of the intuition. So from this kind of beast that he gets, he tries to infer xi and yi if I is equal to j with some probability, and if I is not equal to j, he just says don't know. So I realize this is not completely clear, but this is kind of the problem that boils down to if you do a little bit of information theory. Okay? And what we want to do is relate how well from a tensor product can you infer the underlying coding. We want to relate this to just how well from one component of the tensor product can you get x one of the bits. Yeah? So here we have a problem that is tensor and you want 2 answers. How can we relate it to a problem that is not tensor in one answer? Because this problem has been studied a lot, in particular by Ashwin, and it's called the random access code, right? You have some string, you don't know which bit you want, and you encode it somehow that no matter which bit you want, you can get it. And there are bounded states. Okay? So anyway, this leads us to this problem of bounded state error identification, which is of independent interest. So here's the problem. Let me just start. So if you have a matrix row 0, you have a matrix row 1. Okay. And you want to know, are you in row 0 or row 1, in the usual case. And everybody knows that the optimal success probability is just given by, the bias from half is given by the trace of row 0 minus row 1. This is not hard to show. You just measure the eigenbasis of row 0 minus row 1. So this is well known. Now, what about the modified problem? What if I want, I'm allowing the referee, the person who decides, I'm allowing him some error, I mean, he's not allowed to be very wrong. So here the error probability is given by this term. So let's assume he's not allowed to be wrong. He only is allowed to be wrong with probability epsilon. But on the other hand, sometimes he's allowed to say don't know. This is why I modified the rules of the game which correspond to the previous communication property. Okay. So he can say don't know, but if he says something, with probability A, say, then he has to be right with probability epsilon. This is the new game. It turned out that, well, nobody knows the solution. There's no analytic expression on how, so what we want to know is how big can A be? How often am I allowed to answer something as opposed to saying, of course I can always say no, not very clearly, then I make zero error. But I want to maximize this A, the probability that I actually venture to make a guess. How big can A be? Okay. So this there seems to be no analytic expression for this probability A. The way to do it is to write it as a semi-definite program. It turns out this is exactly the the setting of a semi-definite programming. It's just a solution of a semi-definite program. That's what it is. Anyway, let me just give you an example to illustrate how things can change with this scenario. Let's assume I want to distinguish these two states. Right? I want to see if it's square root of A0 plus this 2 or square root of A1 plus this 2. I want to distinguish these two. So if I just do it with a normal, without doing no, then the trace distance is roughly square root of A. Okay? Okay? So this is the error. The error probability is roughly square root of A. The error probability is roughly half 1 minus square root of A, sorry. Okay, anyway, it relates to square root of A. Now, in the don't know setting, I can do something else. I can measure in a computational basis. If I see 0, I know the output is 0. I mean, I know it must have come from here. If I measure 1, I know it came from here. If I measure 2, I just say don't know. Okay, if you do the math, you see that the error probability is now 0. I never make an error. Whenever I say something 0, 1, I'm always right. But of course now the answer, the error probability, so the answer probability is only A now. So there's a trade-off between being right and saying no. Anyway, the point is that we are in this setting of this allowing ourselves to say don't know because of whatever information theory there. But we have this following problem that now, let's assume we have row 0, row 1, and A is the best A that we can do with error epsilon. And we have sigma 0 and sigma 1, and we know the best probability, the highest probability to say something is B. Let's assume we have maximized this, optimized A and B for a fixed epsilon. And now, because of we have two messages, we have this problem that we have one of these four states. We have either row 0, sigma 0, or 0, sigma 1, or the other two. This is the scenario we have, and we want to identify which of the four it is, right? And we want to relate, so we call this probability to say something that's not don't know, we call it P, for some other epsilon set. And we want to know how does this best P relate to the A and the B. Okay, these things seem to be independent, right? You have something from the left, something from the right. If you only have one thing, then you know the best thing, the best guessing probability is A. If you have the other one, the best one is B. So obviously, if you look at it from probability theory, obviously it must be A times B. I mean, you can't even think twice, right? And we thought this is just a little technicality 2 years ago. We solved it. That's it. 1 year later, we still were solving it. It turned out to be extremely hard to solve. Why is it hard? And we never, we still only have a partial solution to this. So first of all, the question you should always ask, is this true classically? What if your density matrices are diagonal? Right? Remember, you want to prove some sort of direct product theorem. Right? If you can do this well, if you can do this well, then you can do this and this. Turns out classically it's true. This is a good thing. But the optimal measurement that you do on these two registers in this tensor case turns out not to be a tensor measurement. Right? You would think you just do the same thing here as you did if you didn't have a tensor and it would help. No. The optimal measurement is not a tensor product. So this already shows that it's a bit subtle here. It's also quantumly not true if this epsilon prime is bigger than half epsilon. So this relation here, that this scales like a product, is only true, and we have counterexamples, if this epsilon prime, so the guessing probability, the wrong probability in the tensor case, is less than half epsilon. This also we didn't, I mean, it took us a lot of simulations to find this out. And also, you would think very often in computer science, at least it's true, that if these four things are difficult, then it should also be difficult to tell just two versus the other two. So here we have these two parities, I mean the two zeros and the two ones, so parity zero, which is the XOR. And here we have these two mixed pairs. Let's assume we just want to say this, distinguish this from this set. You still would think, intuitively, we thought, intuitively, it would still scale like A times B. The XOR, why would it be, you know, easier? Turns out, no, it's wrong. It can, there are cases where we can scale it with the square root of A times B. So where it can become much larger. So this just shows that we weren't totally dumb when we couldn't prove it. It's just a little bit subtle. And what we show, and we didn't manage to show this general statement. It's still open whether it scales. We believe it does, but we cannot show it. What we can show is that if one side is pure and the other side is mixed, then we can show that it's true for epsilon, which is this relation. The one we expect is true, but only one side is pure. And even then, it was a horrible proof, technical, just calculation, awful. And in general, if you take this and you purify this proof here, then you get a result that is weaker. It relates to the trace distance. Remember, the trace distance can be up to square root bigger, A versus square root A. So this can be up to square root A times B. Anyway, so this is just the story of this. What we call this the tensor lemma, and it's still open. After we prove this tensor lemma, then when you put it all together, you know, these two problems need to be solved, we don't know, etc., you get kind of half n of these state identification problems through the information theory the referee has to solve. Then together with the tensor lemma, you get a lower bound for R1 and also for R2. So luckily, after we proved it, we could at least recycle it for the other relation as well. Okay? Yeah, I'm switching to the very last topic, so if there's a question to this one.
Basically this technique of tensor lemma, this wouldn't extend easily to the case when Alice and Bob share a classical pattern.
I mean, if then the tensor lemma is still true. Is that what you're asking?
In R2
problem, the low bound we need is for public, with public coin. But somehow when you do the information theory, you extract exactly the same subproblem. Yeah. I can just show you it's probably not everything, but it works. You can use it for public one as well. But, yeah, it's a calculation. Okay, so last subtopic, and then we're done. I've talked about relations all the time. That's very unsatisfying, right? I mean, relation, why not the function? So far, nearly except one that I know of, exponential separations, I mean ones that are really log n versus n, are a communication again, are for a relation. So something that can have several answers. You just need to output this bit or this bit or this bit. In particular, just to summarize, the original bias set gyrocumulonimbus, they separate for one round. So when Alice just talks to Bob, and Bob doesn't talk back. They separate classical versus quantum communication. Classical would be much less efficient than quantum, pure public quantum. So that's a relation. Then for the SAP model, I just presented you quantum communication versus public coin. Again, it was a relation. Quantum versus entanglement, again a relation. The only exception is a two-round separation by Langlands, classical versus quantum. Classical with public coin versus quantum. There it's a function. It's a partial function as well, but everything else, the relation is not very nice. Would like a function. The question is there separation for a function? And so this is GKW2 paper. We show that now I'm switching to one round now, but we'll also have an SMP implication. For one round communication, let's see what I want to show. Quantum one round. So Alice can communicate to Bob quantumly. This is much more efficient than if they could communicate classically and had a public coin. So this separation here which is due to BJK formulation, it turns out that there is also a function that does the same situation. This is the recent result. And more precisely, we have here some log n polynomial communication, here again, square root of n. Again, I'll give you just the function in a second. This was independently and on the same day put on the archive proof by also by Ramas and Jordan, Kiranidis. But they have a similar problem by a completely different proof. What's the function? In case you didn't guess, a version of the hidden matching problem, of course. Well, Alice has a string x, and hidden matching is very good for separations. Alice has a string x here, and Bob again has a set of edges, a stored set of edges. This time he doesn't have n over 2 edges, he has slightly less edges, n over square root of n. And Bob also has a string w, so you take these edges and you look at the xor again of the two endpoints, x, in this case x1 and x4, the xor, and you call this z1, and the next xor you call z2, etc. You look at the string of xors, okay, of these edges from the string x. Let's call this z, the string, and then you have another string w, which is either the string z or the string z negated, so everything added to 1. And you want to know, are you in this case or are you in this case? So the function, let's see, so the input just, again, string x, the number of edges, this candidate w, which is either all the xors, or the xors, these edges xored with a bit, which is 1 over here. And the function value is, what's this, are we here, are we here, did we XOR with a bit or did we not? Is that clear or did I manage to? Yeah. Anyway, so this is a problem and it's, let me remind you that the BJK problem was just the same except that it needed to output just some edge and some XOR. So we just added a promise. Quantum protocol again is extremely simple. Alice just sends the same state where she puts all the X, all the bits in the phase, here. This is a small state, log n qubits. She sends it over to Bob, and Bob does this measurement span by edges. Here's the measurement here. If he measures some edge, so it might be that he ends up in this garbage zone here, where there's no edge. But if he has an edge, then he gets again this state in the phase, like the xor, sorry, in the phase. And he just needs to measure in the plus minus. Now we are not on the SNP model, so he just measures in the plus minus spaces and gets that xor. And then he looks. He gets the C and he looks into his W at that position. Is it opposite or is it the same? And if it's the same, you have 0 or 1. Is it okay or am I? Anyway, doesn't matter. Point being that this is log n qubits, and as I told you, you can end up in this garbage zone, but the probability that you don't end up in the garbage zone is 1 over square root of log n. So we just repeat square root of log n times. That's why the communication complexity quantum would be log n square root of log n. And the good part of this protocol is that it's zero error. So you know, if you have outcome L, then you know it. Then you know that you're right. And if you're in the garbage zone, you also know it. So you don't make an error, you just say this was garbage. Anyway, it's a zero error. Separation, zero error versus classical. Okay, just the ideas for the lower bounds. This is fairly standard. Just 3 more minutes. What you do is, okay, you want to show a lower bound for a public coin protocol, one way. So what you do first thing is you apply Yaw's principle, which is just a min-max thing, and say that, let's assume the protocol is deterministic, but you have a distribution on the inputs. If we prove a lower bound for that, that's the same thing. I mean, that shows a lower bound for the probabilistic case. So we assume a uniform distribution on the X string and on the edges, and on the secret bit B. And this fixes the string W, which is just the mask, you know, with a bit of a lot. And then what we do is we assume we have a message of length C bits of communication. Let's assume we have some error, 1 over 10, or whatever it is. Okay, and then we have how many possible messages? There are 2 to the C possible messages, and there are 2 to the N different Xs. Right? So by the ball and bin principle, or whatever it's called, you will have, actually by Markov more or less, you will have that for at least half of the messages, the number of X's that are in the pre-image is 2 to the n minus c minus 1. Right? So on average, we have 2 to the n minus c x's per message, and for at least half the messages, you have half that many x's. Anyway, this is completely standard. And we just, you know, we focus on such a message. A message that has a lot of pre-images, 2 to the n minus c, roughly. Okay? And also, anyway, for this, there is a message, most of them will have error 1 over 5, because we have half some of our reals. So the rest of the argument goes for this message. What you show is that given this message, and now any y, so this message might have many pre-images, lots of x's that you know map to this message, and now this message arrives at Bob's place, and he has some y which was picked uniformly. Okay? And you, what we show is that this distribution of x's, the string of z's that you get, given a message and given a uniform y, if you take the probability of all possible x's, is nearly uniform. Maybe I should repeat it again. So what we show is that this string of possible XORs, given the message, is uniform. Okay? With all possible X's that come from the message. Why is that sufficient? Remember, we needed to distinguish whether this W string is either the Z string or the flipped Z string. So if the distance of the Z string from uniform is delta, this is the same as writing Z plus all zero, meaning the zero string from uniform is delta. And similarly, of course, if you flip everything, since the distance from uniform of z is delta, then also the flip is delta. Okay? And then you use a triangle inequality to show that these two strings have a very small distance from each other, two delta. And because what your task is really is to distinguish this one from this one, if this distance is very small, then you can't do it, then you can't solve the function. Okay? So the hard part of the proof, so this is just, all this Vienna stuff is simple. The hard part of the proof is to show that kind of the distribution of possible XORs, given the edges and the message, is uniform. This is kind of the bulk of the proof. And the reason I'm not going to give you the proof, the reason I'm emphasizing is because there's one last question. There's one last connection to the bounded storage model of bounded storage model. So let me, independent of what I said before, let me make this connection because it's interesting in some sense. So let me make a connection to something that doesn't look the same from at the moment. The following was introduced, I think, by Uli Maurer in the early 90s? Yeah. The following idea to generate a secret key. So he said, okay, I know that you cannot information theoretically generate a secret key. Classically, he didn't know about quantum at the time. How can we do it anyway? What's the trick that I could use to get a secret key between Adam and Billy? Okay, so here's what he does. He says, let's assume you have a huge public string floating by in the sky or something, x1 up to x10. And Adam and Billy already hold a small secret key. So this is the assumption he needs. He needs a small C. Okay, and he'll show how to get more random bits on the C. So Adam and Billy have a secret key. And Eve is the adversary, and the only assumption that is made is that she has bounded storage. So she cannot store this four-little string that's floating by in the sky. She can only store a smaller part of the string. That's the only assumption. Okay, so in the protocol, what happens is this string comes. Adam and Billy use this string and their secret key to generate some secret key Z that is supposedly bigger. But in general, it's just some secret key. And then this beast, this X disappears. And the only trace that is left from the X is the stored message or the stored string that Eve got, which is short. So she couldn't store the whole thing, right? And now, afterwards, what people prove is that the string Z is secure in this scenario, which means it's uniform. I mean, Eve cannot deduce anything about the string. What's more interesting is, later on, Eve learns the secret key by whatever, maybe it was something based on factoring. And later, Eve learns how to factor, so she gets access to the Y. Let's assume. This is one of the arguments, I guess. So even if Eve later learns Y, if she only has this M and nothing else, for her the Z would be totally uniform, close to uniform. Okay. this is what people show in the valid storage key generation. Or, is this clear? What am I talking about this? One of the open questions recently was, does this Z remain secure if the storage is quantum? So let's assume E has quantum storage and not classical. Is this Z still uniform? This was one of the questions people asked. And what follows from our results, in particular from the box thing that I showed, that's that the answer is no, surprisingly enough. There is a very contrived scheme coming from the function I just mentioned where it's not true. So there's a counterexample to this conjecture. And how does it work? Where's the connection? So here's the bounded storage again. I don't need Adam, so forget Adam. So here is Billy, and he has a secret key Y, and he generates a Z. Why is it similar to what we do? What does E do? She has this M of X, right? And she gets Y later on, and she tries to infer Z. That's the scenario. In one-way communication, the thing I just talked early on, there is a message M. Alice has just X, she generates M, just like here. She sends it over, Bob has just Y, and now Bob, given M of X, and Y tries to infer Z. It's exactly the same thing, right? I mean, you can view this as this and this as this. More or less. So our function, just plugging everything in, gives a counterexample, namely something. Remember, we showed that the string Z in the classical case is uniform, more or less, close to uniform. So, what it shows is that if you have classical storage up to this bound square root n, we have something that is secure in the bounded storage model. However, if you give this adversary here this much quantum storage, or even much less actually, this thing is far from uniform, because for every log n bits, she can get one bit of the Z's with this protocol I showed you before. For each. So she just stores many copies of this, putting xi in the face, many copies of this, and each one gives you a z bit with some probability. Right? So you roughly get square of n bits of z's. You can get a lot of bits of z, whereas here you can really get not even one. So there's a counterexample to this conjecture, which I heard of recently, to the bounded storage kind of quantum classical. Okay. Maybe I'll skip this. So. Just to say that this another corollary of this result is also you can just immediately translate this to the SNP model and separate entanglement based for a function again. Entanglement against no entanglement public quantum classical. Anyway, this is just a trivial observation more or less. So let me summarize. I go backwards in my summary. So what I showed you recently in the last slides is a one-round separation for a Boolean function. And also in this last slide that I did, it's found out with SNP separation. Okay, and also something, an example where something becomes insecure in the quantum bounds, in the bounded storage model if E is quantum. Okay. Before that, I spoke about these quantum state identification problems and the tensor lemma. I showed you how to look at classical communication and shared randomness can beat quantum communication. This was R1. I can show you, I showed you that classical is much weaker than shared entanglement, this is R2, and I told you something about fingerprints. And there are many open questions, just to some of them. There's this issue, we had this function and it was a promise problem, so it's a partial function, not all inputs have an answer, a definite answer. Is there an exponential separation for a total function? So the minds split on this, I think people generally tend to believe the answer is no. But it's not known. I mentioned that the tensor lemma was a total beast to prove even in the restricted case of one side being pure. It's still open to show it in the general case. And if you could show it in the general case, it would tighten our lower bound for R1. It would make it among many other things, I guess. I showed you a separation where Ray guessed that entanglement is much better than a public Hoyle quantum. Could there be a separation the other way around? Is there a relation that separates it the other way around? It's not known. And, yeah, among other things, are there other implications of the tensor? Thank you.
So, this bounded storage thing, does... So you said the classical case, classical storage, that Z is almost uniform.
Yes.
So does that follow immediately from the communication complexity result?
That's what we show. It doesn't follow from the result, but that's what we show as an intermediate step.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't follow from the final thing, but it follows from the proof.
It doesn't follow from the last result, the last 10 minutes, because they have a different proof, but it follows from our proof.
Okay.
But by the way, this is their reference, their
part.